guests that are here with us today, and good to see all of you. My wife felt she helped out my daughter, and that is nice to be able to help out, but you get to stay up late and get up early, and my daughter's adjusting to it and realizing, boy, this is a lot more work than I ever thought it would be. We're like, you can't turn them on and off. They're here, and you got to get up, and you got to take care of them, and it is a lot of responsibility. But you know, as mothers, you've all been through that and know that that's a great responsibility. But they're also a real pleasure to spend time with. We have some. I put some holy day forms out. I don't know if anybody would need them, but if you're going to take off for the feast, then you can pass those things along to your employer and have those things covered with them. So. put those out for you today, and also we have some home office updates, kind of give you an idea of what's going on in the church at this time. Next week, Sabbath services will be held here, as usual, at 11 a.m., so it'll be September already, so September 5th we'll meet here at 11 a.m. Mr. Errett will be down to conduct services next Sabbath, so we'll hard to believe September begins. We're already close to the holy days. The 19th will be the Feast of Trumpets, and we'll have holy day services here at 10:30, and then on the 28th we'll have the Day of Atonement, and we'll have services here at 10. And so we'll look forward to being able to get together on the holy days, and look forward to that special time ahead that God set apart for all of us. One of the great challenges that we face in this time is different ailments, the flu and that kind of thing. So they ask us to announce, make this following announcement in regard to the swine flu or the H1N1 influenza virus, since it is a problem in our society, and they're worried about possibly it being a pandemic which will spread throughout nations and really take a lot of lives, possibly. Hope that doesn't happen, but we know in 1918 it did. The news media and responsible public health professionals have asked all organizations to implement programs to minimize the dangers posed by the recently discovered H1N1 influenza virus. As responsible citizens and Christians, it's important that we do our part. Therefore, we would like to enlist the help of the membership in establishing the following guidelines for local services and for the Feast of Tabernacles. First of all, know the signs and symptoms of flu. I know Mrs. Butcher's not here today, and she thinks she has, she's definitely sick, but she's not sure what she has, and to come to church sick is bad for everybody. So symptoms of flu include fever or chills and cough or sore throat. In addition, symptoms of flu can include runny nose, body aches, headache, tiredness, diarrhea, or vomiting. So if you're having those problems, maybe it's the best idea you don't come. So, self-imposed quarantine is a biblical principle. If you're sick, stay home or at your place of residence for at least 24 hours after there is no longer a fever or signs of fever. And this should be determined without the use of fever-reducing medication. So if you take Tylenol and reduce your fever, that's not the time to say, well, I'm in good shape. Also, the flu often lasts for several days. If you become ill with the flu while at the feast, you may want to consider returning home before the end of the feast if that's possible. Wash your hands often with soap and water, especially after coughing or sneezing. Alcohol-based hand cleaners are also effective if soap and water are not available. If things are getting worse, contact a healthcare professional. And please do not come to services or... Please do not come to services or bring sick children to services to get anointed. You're encouraged to call the elders if you need to be anointed. And if you would prefer not to have anyone come to you, you're welcome to request an anointed cloth. So those are some things you might keep in mind to come to services sick and seek to be anointed kind of defeats the purpose. So anyway, we last Sabbath. This is not working, is it? What's that?
He can't hear
that. Oh, he can't hear that.
That's the problem.
we can hear it. Okay. So if we're cringing, it's bad. So anyway, last week it was nice to go to church in Houston, and my son's dating a girl from Houston, and interestingly, her father went to school when I went to school at Ambassador College. And the interesting thing is, as we started talking, didn't register with me, but he started school. I'd put in a year, it was the second year, and he came to school, and so we were going to school at the same time, but he went home to Miami after a month. And I remembered that because they had put me into a certain part of the campus to stay, and I didn't like that part, and I wanted to be in the dorm. And so I remember going to the student body president, who had an effect on where you stayed, and said, you know what, this guy's going home. How about if I can have his space when he leaves? So actually the father of the girl my son's dating is, I took his spot when he left to go back to Miami. So I told him, well, I was hoping you'd go home soon so I could move in there. But anyway, no, so it's a small world, you know, and you go someplace and meet somebody, especially in the church. Many times, you know, we've been around for years and our paths will have crossed. You know, as we look at our money, you can look on it and it says, in God we trust. And so we're all very familiar with that. I don't think we as a nation do trust God, though. It may be on our money, but that doesn't mean much. In God we trust. And the question we might ask ourselves in light of that is, do we trust God? Do we trust God? Now, that may seem like a strange question to begin with, since we all profess to be Christians, and as Christians, we are supposedly have faith in God, and we all trust Him. But what prompted that question was a study of Proverbs. Now, let's go to Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3. Verse 6. Or start in verse 5. Proverbs 3, verse 5 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. So in verse 5 tells us that we are to trust in God with all of our being. And lean not on your own understanding. So if you trust in God with all your heart, basically what you're saying is that you trust God is going to do what He said He's going to do. That whatever matter you're dealing with, that you trust God to work it out for you. And we're not to lean to our own understanding. And it's easy to say, well, I trust God, until we get into a tight spot. And then it's very easy to begin to lean on your own understanding. Verse 6 says, in all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. So if we acknowledge God, He says, well, I will direct your path. And as He directs your path, you have to realize, well, you know what? It may not be the path I want to go down. That's not the path I planned on. But if we trust in God, then He'll show us the right path. But sometimes that's an awfully hard thing to do, to trust God with all of our being. So as you look at that proverb, you have to ask yourself, do I trust God to the degree that it tells us to do here in the proverb? What does it mean? Trust versus faith, are they the same thing? So you see that there's the word trust and there's also the word faith. Are they the same? Or is there a difference between the two of them? Hopefully as we go through the sermon, you'll see there is a difference. If you look at the wording for trust and the word for faith, they're different. They aren't the same. And they're different because God's trying to get across a different concept to us. So we'll try to clarify what that means. So to help begin the clarification, let's go to Psalm 25. Psalm 25. And this is a psalm of David, one that he wrote. And let's begin in verse 1. Psalm 25, verse 1. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. Oh my God, I trust in you. Let me not be ashamed. Let not my enemies triumph over me. And so David trusts in God. He says, Oh my God, I trust in you. I trust you, God, that everything's going to work out. And David definitely needed a trust in God because of all the challenges that David faced. David was constantly having difficulties with enemies and in battles and had to run for his life in different circumstances, and things were rather perilous from time to time. But he says, I trust in you, and don't let my enemies triumph over me. Verse 3, indeed, let no one who waits on you be ashamed. And sometimes that's what we have to do, isn't it, as we wait on God. When will God show us the way? When will God answer our prayer? When will God help our plan to work out? And where will He help us to see we need to change our plan? He says, let those who be ashamed who deal treacherously without cause. And sometimes David had to deal with treachery, people that sought to overthrow him or battle against him. He had to battle against Saul and flee from him and hide out. And he lived for years living in hiding. And the thing is, he said that he said he trusts in God. He goes on to say here in Psalm 25, it said the word is that is used there. He said, I trust in you. And the word trust there is interesting because it in the Hebrew it means security. It means quietness. And when you have a trust in somebody, you can count on them. And you don't worry about whether they're going to come through with whatever you're trusting them with. So you can be at peace. You can say, well, you know, I know they're going to come through. They always have. I trust them. And now, if you don't trust them, you're worried. You're anxious, aren't you? You're anxious that maybe this isn't going to work out or they aren't going to come through. But if you do trust them, there is a certain security that you have, a certain quietness, a peace that comes from that trust. And that's the kind of trust that David had in God. And it's the kind of trust that we should have in God as well. That when we go to God and we tell Him our plan or we tell Him what we're trying to get worked out or what our vision of things is, that He hears our prayer and that He's responding. And we can trust that He's going to do what is best for all of us. And David got plenty of opportunities to develop that trust in God. And you know, as you think about trust is something that is developed. Do you just trust anybody you meet? Now, that may be a good policy. You trust them till they prove otherwise. But living in the day and age in which we live, probably we better trust, but we better verify what they're doing. Are they honest? Are they misusing us? Are they misleading us in some way? And as we go along in our relationship, what happens? Our trust is built. And so David had a relationship with God, and through his experience, he had come to trust God. And so when he got into difficulties, he can say, I trust in you. I feel secure that you're going to work this out. Now let's think about trust versus faith. Trust versus faith, are they the same thing? Well, not really. Let's go to Romans chapter 8. And see an example that helps to illustrate this. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 9. But you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. So he's speaking to Christians, and he's telling them that as a Christian, if God's Spirit dwells in you, then you are Christ. You are a Christian, and you, without God's Spirit, you are not His, as it goes on to say at the end of the verse. And if Christ is in you, the body is dead because of sin. So Christ is living in you, and your sins have been forgiven, your sins have caused would have caused your mortal body to die. It will die at some point, but as we live on and we've accepted Christ, then our sins are forgiven. But the Spirit is life because of righteousness. The Spirit is life because the Spirit leads us to live righteously, to live in a way that is in harmony with God. Verse 11, but if the Spirit of Him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, if God's Spirit dwells in you, then it says, God the Father, who raised Christ from the dead, will also give life to your mortal bodies through the Spirit who dwells in you. So faith rests on specific promises. And the specific promise we're looking at here in these verses is if we die in the faith today or tomorrow, then God will fulfill His promise to resurrect us to life. That's a promise that He has made, that He will raise us to life at the coming of Jesus Christ. It's something that we know fundamentally. That's why we keep the Feast of Trumpets, because it is a reminder that that Christ will return and that there will be a resurrection of the dead. And those dead will rise to meet Christ, and they will dwell with Him forever in the kingdom of God. It is a promise. And as we look at these things, as we think about the subject of faith, we believe in those things. We have faith in them. But trust has to do with trials in a different way. For example, as we face financial problems, how do we deal with that? Do we trust God as we deal with it? And it's very challenging to trust God when you're facing adversity. It is very difficult. We've been, my wife and I have been through financial trials in the past, and it's easy to say, okay, we trust God with this. But it's very easy to begin to say, well, you know, I don't know, when's God going to come through? And how's He going to come through? How's this going to work out? And you're kind of like on a plat, you know, you're going up and down, up and down. I know God's going to do it. God can do it, but He's not doing it. What's the hold up here? Because we all want God to act instantaneously. And that's the way it is with trials, that God doesn't do that. And we learn certain things through the process. Let's go to Psalm 37. Psalm 37. And you may wonder, well, why did David go through all the trials that he did? Because his whole life is one trial after another. And why are they all recounted for us? Well, the reason is because God was teaching David certain lessons. And He was instilling in David a trust in God. Psalm 37, verse 25. It says, I have been young, and now am old. So I was young once, and now I'm an old man. Yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken. So I've been young, I've been old, and through the process of time, I've not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. I've seen that God comes through for the righteous. God comes through for the righteous. But that's true, that God is going to come through for the righteous, but it doesn't tell you when relief will come. It doesn't tell you when God will answer that prayer, when God will intervene. Doesn't necessarily tell us how it will work out. Doesn't tell us how much we'll have to go through. Because there are times we have to go through some very serious adversities. And as we look at the time in which we live right now, the potential for adversity, I think, is pretty high. It is becoming I've said before, a much less church-friendly world. And we look at a world that's very uncertain now. And all of those, and adversity could come our way. I mean, if you looked at people living in the 1920s, the 1920s were a time of great prosperity in America. People were thriving. The stock market's going up, everything's going well. And then you had the crash, and things, it seemed to be coming out of it, and you went up and you went down, you went up and you went down. And you had during that time the Dust Bowl. You know, people had moved to Oklahoma and started farming, and all of a sudden here comes the Dust Bowl, and these people are uprooted, many of them moving to California. And times were tough. And we live in an age in which difficult times could come our way again. So the question is, as they come, will we trust God? And those adversities can come our way and cause us to be challenged. Now, let's look at an example of trust. A man went to an auction, and at the auction, as they're bringing out the things that were being auctioned off, one of the things that he saw that he liked was a painting. And so he bid on the painting, and he won. He got the painting. He was willing to pay the necessary dollars to cause everybody else to say, you can have it for that price. So he bought the painting. On leaving, he's getting ready to leave and settle up with the auctioneer, and he's looking for his checkbook, but he didn't have it. And as he looked at how much he had bid on the painting, he also didn't have quite enough cash to carry forth the transaction. And he also noticed a sign that the auctioneer had up. It said, no credit cards today. Oops, I'm in a bad way. And usually as you're at an auction and you bid on something and you win the bid, then they sort of expect you to pay for it. And so he's wondering, oh no, what am I going to do? So he's talking to the lady that's taking care of the transactions, and she informed him that they could take his credit card number, charge the card, and then destroy the paper on which the card number had been written down. So you're going to trust them. You're going to, okay, here's my credit card number, my date that the card expires, and here's my security code. And I'm going to give you all of that and trust that everything's going to be okay. Now, how many of you would give that to the auctioneer? I would think twice about it. I might think, I don't need that painting so much, Ken. I hate to welch on the deal, but I don't have the money. But this person thought about it and said, well, yeah, I'll go ahead and do this. Because, you know, as you think about the auctioneer, this person probably lives in a community. And if you're auctioning things off, and you're known in the community. So if you misuse this credit card number, it's going to affect your name, and it's going to have an effect on your business. So the person agreed to go ahead and give him his information because he was sure the auctioneer wanted to protect his good name. And trusting God is like that. It's based on his name and his character. God is a God of character that we can trust in. You know, one of the statements about God is that he is ever faithful. You can always be sure of him. Now, human beings, not so much. But God, you can count on him in every situation at all times. And this should be our stance toward God, our overall approach. Because of his name, we trust him. Because of who God is and his character, we trust him. Now, faith flows from specific promises. And perhaps you've seen bumper stickers that read, God says it, I believe it, and that's that. You may have seen that bumper sticker around. It is interesting, in certain parts of the country, I don't believe you see that bumper sticker much, but in other parts of the country, you'll see it. And as we were making our way from Ohio, we drove down to Texas, and and as we're making our way south, it was interesting. You see different signs that you would never see up in the north, okay? It's more of the Bible Belt, and people are more biblically oriented in those communities. And so it was interesting to me to see the anti-abortion signs and different signs like that that you might not see elsewhere. And there were other signs that I was surprised about the importance of worshiping God and that kind of thing. I thought, we wouldn't see that where I live. But anyway, you did see it on our trip there and as we moved south. But trust comes from knowledge of God's character. For instance, we know that we're told in 1 John that God is love. God is love. And what that means is everything that He does is based upon outgoing concern for you and me. Everything He does is based upon love. It means that He will always do the best for His people. And we can count on that because the Bible also tells us that God's the same yesterday, today, and forever. In His character, God doesn't change. It's always the same. He treats me the same as He did to people, all of us the same as He did to people 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And 1,000 years from now, He will treat people the same. God doesn't change. He's always the same. Now let's go to Psalm 31. Psalm 31. And we're using a number of psalms today because David experienced the need to trust God quite a bit, so he wrote about it quite often. Psalm 31. And let's look at verses 1 through 6. And these verses are a petition to God. David is petitioning God, just as we might petition God in prayer. He said, "In You, O Lord, I put my trust. I put my trust in You. Let me never be ashamed. Deliver me in Your righteousness. Bow down Your ear to me." You know, bow down Your ear to me. Listen to me. Hear my prayer. "Deliver me speedily. Be my rock of refuge, a fortress of defense to save me." So obviously he needed protection. And probably if we needed protection, we would want God to deliver us speedily. I would. Don't wait around on this, God, because this is kind of a hairy situation. And he needed God's intervention speedily. And he's saying, "God, You're my refuge. You're the place that I can go and have protection. You're my fortress of defense to save me. For You are my rock and my fortress. Therefore, for Your name's sake, lead me and guide me." You know, he's invoking God's name. And he's saying, you know what? Because Your name indicates certain things. It indicates certain things about who and what You are. So please lead me and please guide me. And that's an indication, you know what? He's asking God, now, what's the best path to go down? You know, like if you look in Corinthians, it talks about that God will not give us more to bear than we can bear. But it's interesting, as you look at that verse, it not only says that God won't put on you more than you can bear, but it also says that God will provide not a way of escape, but the way of escape. So if you trust God, God will allow you to be able to escape whatever it is, not just any old way, but the best way. And sometimes we conclude this is the best path to go down, and God says, well, that's really not the best path. If you'll wait on me, I'll give you the best path. So he says here, "Lead me and guide me. Pull me out of the net which they have secretly laid for me, for You are my strength. Into Your hand I commit my spirit. You have redeemed me, O Lord God of truth." So he committed himself into God's hand. Is that what we do? It's hard. You know, it's easy to talk about it. But when you're facing adversity, that's when you say, "God, I put myself into Your hand. And I'm going to trust that You'll take care of me." Let's go to Psalm 34. Psalm 34, and look at verses 8 through 10. Psalm 34, verses 8 through 10. And this is interesting in the way that it's phrased. It says, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Taste and see that the Lord is good." And it's interesting, people want an empirical proof that God exists. You know, if I can see Him, I can feel Him, I can touch Him, you know, then I know He exists. And what David's telling you, I've never, you know, even if you don't see Him, you can taste God. He's talking about through your senses, you can know that there is a God. And taste and see that God is good. You can tangibly know that God exists. "Blessed is the man who trusts in Him. Oh, fear the Lord, you His saints. There is no want to those who fear Him. The young lions lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing." Any good thing. So, we can trust God as a result of getting to know Him, coming to see and to taste that He is good. And trust is built by our relationship with Him. I trust God more today than when I started out as a Christian. And as we go through experiences in life and we walk with God and we interact with Him, as we go through those experiences, what it should do is reassure us that God is there and God will work it out. And not everything is going to be just a gigantic, you know, one miracle after another. But God helps things to work out, things to come your way. I know that a friend of mine in the ministry was trying to sell his house in Lansing, Michigan, which selling a house in Michigan is a tough experience right now. So he's trying to sell his house in order that he can move to Little Rock, Arkansas, and begin working with the churches there. Well, he's got all sorts of houses on his street that are for sale. And he said, they're better houses than my house. And nobody's even looked at his house in the time that he's had it up for sale. So you're thinking, how's this going to work out? And I didn't ask him whether he just had total confidence, total trust in God, and never wavered for a minute. I didn't ask him that. But I asked him, I wrote and asked, I said, "Well, how are things going on your house sale?" And he said, "Actually, the house sold. The first people that came and looked at it bought it." And he said, "It's a minor miracle." And I thought, sorry, Fred. That was a major miracle in Michigan to sell your house and to have one party come to your house and look at it and buy it. So, did God intervene in that situation? I would imagine they had been praying about it, and other people had been praying about it, and God opened the door for the house to sell. So, God is good. And as we trust in Him, as we go through experiences in our relationship with God, and we go through those kind of things that are important to us, and we see God's hand in it, and you see, there's no way this could have worked out without God helping it to work out. Somehow or other, God motivated those people to buy that house. So He's very thankful, and I'm very thankful for Him. But it just reminds us that God can intervene and do things for us that seem impossible. God is reliable, and He's trustworthy. And God loves His people and always does what's best for them. And we can count on that. Now, let's look at how this plays out. And first of all, trust in God isn't passive. Trust in God isn't passive. And let's look at an example in 1 Samuel chapter 13. Trust in God is not passive. And this example is from the time of David and Saul, about 1000 B.C. And one of the great threats to the people of Israel at that time were the Philistines. They were Israel constantly was fighting with them. And we see an example of this in 1 Samuel chapter 13, beginning in verse 19. 1 Samuel 13, verse 19. Now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout the land of Israel. So living in that time, you needed a blacksmith in order to be able to function, to sharpen your implements. You know, if you were farming, you needed your plow sharpened and your axe sharpened in order to chop wood. You needed those were basic necessities of life in order that you could function on your farm. But there was no blacksmith in Israel. Now, why was that? Well, the Philistines were controlling things. And they controlled what was sharpened, and their primary purpose in limiting blacksmiths in Israel was to make sure that those blacksmiths weren't making swords and spears and other weapons. They were, no weapons. They can't fight against us very well. So there was no blacksmith in Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for sharpening was a pim, for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to set the points of the goads. So it came about on the day of the battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and Jonathan his son. So here they are on the brink of a battle, and they don't have swords, they don't have spears, and they're going to fight against the Philistines. Now, frankly, if I was in a fight, I would want to be well armed versus, not having anything. I'm sure they may have had to sticks or whatever it may be, but they were not well armed. The only people that had armaments were Saul and his son Jonathan. So, we have to ask ourselves, would we go out and fight against an enemy that we know to be well armed when we're not armed? I don't believe I would consider that to be imprudent. But there they were. Let's go to chapter 14. Beginning in verse 1. Now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell his father. So here's one. There are two people that are armed, Jonathan and Saul. So he said, "Let's go over to the Philistines' garrison." So here's one man and his armor bearer. Verse 2, "And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, and the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other Sinna. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, 'Come, and let us go to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or few.'" Now, this is trusting in God. An example here of Jonathan crossing this deep gorge between Michmash and Geba. And even though Jonathan had implements, the Philistines were overwhelmingly superior. And the thing we want to note here in verse 6 is what Jonathan says. He says, "It may be that the Lord will work for us." It may be that the Lord will work for us. Basically saying, who knows? God may work for us. He displayed an attitude of courage and uncertainty. But not fearful uncertainty, but an attitude of trust in God. God may work this out. And so let's put him to the test that God would work it out. And, you know, sometimes that's what we have to do. As we are God's people, we have to trust that God will work it out. We can't just passively sit back and do nothing. You have to take some action. When should we be passive and when should we be active, we might ask. When should we be passive and when should we be active? Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. And I'm going to read this in a different translation because it's worded a little bit in a way that I think you might understand what it's saying more fully. It talks about casting your bread on the waters. And he's not talking about feeding ducks or fish or something like that, chumming the fish. That's not exactly what he's talking about there. So what is he talking about? Well, this different translation helps you to understand. Chapter 11, verse 1, it says, send your resources out over the seas. So it's talking about merchants. You know, and if you're a merchant, you know, you have your merchandise and you're going to put it on a ship and you're going to send it out from that port and you're going to try to sell that merchandise. Well, as you put the merchandise on the ship, are you absolutely sure that you're going to get a return on it? There's an exercise of faith. We're told here, send your resources out over the seas. Eventually, you will reap a return. Verse 2, divide your merchandise into 7 or 8 shares. So don't put it all in one basket, but spread it out and send it in 7 or 8 different directions. Since you don't know what disasters may come on the earth. For instance, I'm listening to a guy that talks about investing in stocks, following the charts. And he said, you know, just telling you that if you invest in 5 stocks, you'll lose on 3 of them, but you'll win on 2. And the 2 that you win on will make up for what you lose on the other 3. But if you prudently invest, and he's telling you up front, so you put your stock, your money out in 5 different directions, and you're going to win on 2 of them, but 3 of them you're going to lose on probably. That's just the way it works. And now I don't want to lose on any, but that's not the way it works. And as we invest ourselves or invest our assets or resources, not everything is going to work out. But if you don't invest at all, you get no return. So you have to send it out in different directions because you don't know what disasters may come on the earth. If the clouds are full of rain, they impede themselves on the earth. Whether a tree falls toward the north or the south, the place where the tree falls is where it stays. And as we well know, it may be raining over 10 miles from where we live, but where we live, we're not getting a drop. That's the way it is. And you pray, God, please help some of that to fall on me because I've got a garden or whatever it may be, or replenish my water supply. So he who keeps watching the wind will never sow. He who keeps looking at the clouds will never reap. Why is that? Because you're waiting for perfect conditions. I'm waiting. When it's perfect, I'll do it. But if it's not perfect, I'm not going to do it. Now, you have to prudently say, you know, the conditions just aren't right to do it. You know, to plant something, many things in February is unwise because it's still cold and it's not going to do anything. But if you wait a few months, you can put those things out and they'll do fine. And there you wait for the conditions, but it may not be absolutely perfect. And he's talking about some people never do anything because they wait until everything is perfect. And in all probability, you'll never do anything if you're waiting for everything to just be perfect. Verse 5, just as you don't know the way of the wind or how bones grow in a pregnant woman's womb, so you don't know the work of God, the maker of everything. How many of us know exactly what God's going to do or what he's thinking? We don't. So there are things we just don't know. But we trust in God. says, "In the morning sow your seed, and don't slack until evening. For you don't know which sowing will succeed, and this or that, or if both will do well." So, venture forth and cast your bread on the water. Send your resources out over the seas, and eventually you'll reap a harvest. And we have to do the same thing. We have to step out to a certain degree and trust that God will help things to work out. Ecclesiastes is a philosophical book, but it assumes that one is going to God in prayer and asking God to guide it all. You know, if we lose our job, what do? We wait till God gives us a call and tells us, "Well, I've got a job lined up for you over here." That's not how it works. You go out and you start looking for a job. And you bang on the doors, you answer classified ads, and you keep knocking till you find something. But you also ask God to guide what's best to work out. You know, as we think about, for some people, like, you know, they're dating, they're looking for a mate. Well, would you want God to be involved in that? That'd probably be a good thing. Who you marry might be important. Having a family. When's the best time? Will God bless you? Ask God that He would bless you in that way to give you a child at the right time. You ask God for all these things. And God's direction can be unpredictable, but God answers. But we don't in ways we don't anticipate. And why is that? Because God wants us to learn trust. He doesn't tell you everything. Okay, you do this, and this is going to work out. We don't get that message. Have you gotten that? I haven't. Now, I know when it's all said and done, if I'm faithful, I'll be resurrected and be a part of God's family. But in the interim, I've got things to face, and I don't know exactly how everything is going to work out. But I know from experience that if I trust God and go to Him in prayer and ask for His guidance direction, it will work out. Maybe not exactly the way I thought, but it will work out. You know, in my life, I grew up in California. I never expected to be in Peoria, Illinois, nor in St. Louis, Missouri, nor in Dallas, Texas, nor in Southern Ohio. But here I am. And I think God's hand was in all of that, but it's worked out, and I know God has blessed us. But when I was 18, 19, 20 years old living in California, I didn't expect to be where I'm at today. I mean, are you exactly where you thought you would be when you were 20? Have things worked out exactly as you thought they would when you were 20? I don't think so. Maybe they did. For some rare individuals, maybe they do, but for most of us, they don't. But what we want to do as we go through life is ask for God's guidance and things to work out in the way that's best for us as we go forward. That His hand is in everything. And as we go through those experiences, we begin to trust Him. Another thing that we need to consider is okay, but sometimes it's, "I've done all I can, really. Now it's in God's hands." And that's the way it is sometimes. An example of that is found in Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14. Now, have you ever come to that point where you've done everything you can and there's nothing more you can do? It's in God's hands now. Exodus chapter 14, verses 1 through 4 talk about Israel leaving Egypt. And as they left Egypt on that first day of unleavened bread and began their journey out of Egypt, they had made their way along and had come to the Red Sea. And God had led them along to a position where they were stuck, where there are mountains on either side, there's the Red Sea in front of them, and behind them is Pharaoh's army. You're stuck. And God had led them to this point. It was God's doing. It was because of God that they were in that position. And you know, you think, and I'm sure they were thinking, "Well, God, what have you done to us? How have you put us into this position?" Well, God did this for a reason. God did this for a reason because He was trying to teach them something. Now, Moses when he had begun his relationship with God, back with the burning bush, he had gone through various things and learned to trust God over time. But Israel wasn't at the same point. They still had lessons to learn, and this was one of them. So there they are between the old saying, between the devil and the deep blue sea. And there was nowhere for them to go to escape. So what else can they do here but put it in God's hands? Let's go down to verse 10. Exodus 14, verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt so with us to bring us up out of Egypt?" So who are they looking to? Who put them in this predicament? Moses, you did this. How could you lead us into a trap? There is no way of escape. And are they trusting in God here? They aren't. Now, Moses did, but they didn't. And all they could see was their predicament. And verse 12, "Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'?" You know, hey, it's bad here, but we'd rather put up with being slaves than follow you. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever." Stand still, he said. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. And sometimes it's like that for you and me. We have nowhere to go. And we have to stand still. And as we are in that predicament, we're in that situation, God is teaching us, you have nowhere to go but to trust me. And we will probably all, if we haven't, we will all come to that point where there is no wiggle room, there is no way of escape. We're stuck there, just like Israel, and God has led us to that point to teach us something, to teach us that we can trust him, that he will work it out for us. Sometimes, as we look at this subject, we can be too independent. Let's go to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. We can be too independent and trust that we know the best way. James chapter 4. Basically, we say, okay, I trust God, but here's my plan. James chapter 4, verse 13. "Come now, you who say, 'Today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit.'" So that's the plan. We'll go here, we'll go there and we'll make a profit. And verse 14, "Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. How do you know you're going to be here a year from now? How do you know? Instead, you ought to say, 'If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that.'" It's a different mindset that God, I'm walking with God and I want God involved in whatever I'm doing. That if it's God's will, then this will work out. If it's not God's will, it won't. But God's very much involved in this. There's nothing wrong with having a plan. You should have some kind of a plan in your life. But what you want to do is have God involved. We want to submit our plan to God first. Now, this isn't passivity, but an element of trust. We trust that God will show us the way. That God will show us if our plan is flawed or there is a better way to work it out, that God will be involved. So we want to have plans, but we want to submit them to God. We need to declare, my life is in God's hands and I trust Him. I have a plan, but it may not be God's plan for me. And if it is God's will, let my plan come to pass. And if God has plans for me that are different from mine, trust God that He knows what He's doing. Okay? This isn't exactly what I thought, but here we are. For instance, I never planned to be a minister, but here I am. Okay, so that wasn't the plan at 18 or 19 or 20, but here I am. Next thing to consider is sometimes we say, I've turned it over to God. I've turned it over to God. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 5. First Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. Peter was a man who had learned to trust God. And we'll look at a story that shows, made a real example of how Peter came to trust God. First Peter 5, verses 6 and 7. Here Peter says, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time. God will lift you up in due time. It doesn't say immediately. Verse 7 says, casting all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. You see, God cares for you because this whole plan that's going on here is about you and me and every other human being that has lived or is living or will live. That's the whole point of everything. So you don't think He cares for you? He most certainly does, and especially those whom He's called at this point. So as we humble ourselves before the mighty hand of God, and we seek Him, then He will exalt us in due time. And we cast all our care upon Him, knowing that He does care for us. We turn it over to Him because God has broad shoulders, He's powerful, and why should I worry? That's hard to do. Sometimes we turn it over to Him and then we take it back. Well, I'm not sure God's going to work this out. And as you look at examples in the Bible of people who should have trusted God and didn't and took it back into their own hand, how did that work out? Think about Abraham. God said, I am going in through your descendants, I'm going to bless everybody on earth. And you will have a descendant. So did Abraham wait on God to work it out? Now, if you look at that story, it was a long time before it actually worked out. So what solution did Abraham come up with? Well, we'll have a child through the handmaid. How did that work out? It didn't work out with his wife, Sarah. It didn't work out with the handmaid, Hagar. It didn't work out with Ishmael, the child. And the problems that stem from that still exist. They're still going on in the Middle East today. So you start something, and it could go on for thousands of years, which that story has is still going on. It's still unfolding. And that wasn't his intention, but working it out himself sometimes has long-term consequences. And so we have to think about that. Okay, I've asked God to intervene, and He's taking a long time, so I'm going to work it out. If you do, just take note of how that goes. Sometimes good, not so good. So, it's a hard thing to do. I'm not saying that I'm the most, you know, that I always trust God, and oh, I never ever falter. That's not true. When I was transferred from Illinois to St. Louis, we had to sell our house. In 1985, when we sold the house, it was the market in Peoria, Illinois, was the pits. Trying to sell a house there was like trying to sell a house in Michigan. So it wasn't selling. And we prayed about it, we fasted about it, we did, you know, all the things we thought we should do, and nothing was happening. And and it was a roller coaster, you know, because you're making double house payments and all this kind of stuff. So it was kind of a roller coaster experience. And I can't say that we were totally trusting in God. You know, we would always go back to God, but as I said, it's a roller coaster when you go through those things. If you're sick or you're facing some kind of trial, it's hard to just be absolutely steady. That's what we want to grow to, where we implicitly trust God and we don't waver, but sorry, most of us are human beings and we do waver. But the reason God keeps putting us through things is to help us to develop the trust. It's like David. David went through it over and over and over and over again, and he became a person who trusts in God. And that's what God is trying to develop in all of us. So we need to turn things over to God and leave it with Him. It's okay to repeat the petition, but it's not okay to break trust. We don't want to come to the point of saying, you know, God's not going to come through, so I'll work it out. And so we looked at the thought of the example of Abraham. We need to really trust God. Now, Peter makes this statement here that we should just trust God, cast all our cares upon Him. Is that the way Peter was? Think back to Peter on the Sea of Galilee, and there's a storm. And the disciples were on the boat, but Christ wasn't. And then they saw Christ walking across the Sea of Galilee, and they noted it was Christ. And what did Peter say? He said, "Well, let me come to you." And you know, I'm sure Peter understood from being a fisherman and being around the water all the time that if you jump in the water, you're going to sink. I would think a fisherman would know that. So I'm sure he understood that, but Christ said, "Come," and he did. And he was actually walking on the water. But then he probably stopped and thought, "Okay, wait a minute, what am I doing?" And maybe the waves were swelling or whatever. But he lost focus and sank. Christ saved him. But you don't think that Peter remembered that throughout his life? That he had to implicitly trust Christ. And when he stopped trusting Christ, that's when he foundered. I think he learned that lesson and could pass it along to the church when he wrote his letter. Now, I'd like to conclude with a story. It's really an interesting story about a trapeze artist. This trapeze artist was quite skilled, and he could cycle on a tightrope. And once he claimed that he would cross the Great Niagara Falls cycling on the tightrope. If you've been to Niagara Falls, it's a pretty imposing place and a lot of water going over there. And if you fall into that raging water, you're probably not going to be found again. Some people, you know, go over in barrels and all kinds of things. But I'm not going over on a tightrope, or I'm definitely not cycling over on that. But this man had enough confidence in his ability to stretch that tightrope across there and to walk across it or to cycle across it. Hearing of this event, many spectators from far and wide came to watch this spectacular feat. People were waiting with bated breath to watch him do this impossible feat. But somehow they had a belief that the trapeze artist would actually, he had the skill to do it and he would actually succeed. You know, a lot of times as you have events like this, they go to see if he'll fail. Wow, he fell a long way into that water. And, you know, the people jumping over buses on motorcycles and all that, there is a certain element of the group there that's not wanting him to succeed. And I'm sure there were those people there at that time as well. Then the trapeze artist not only skillfully crossed to the other side, but also cycled his way back to glory. And there was a great applause celebrating the expertise and courage of the man. And then, to the surprise of everyone, the artist invited a volunteer from the crowd to accompany him in his exploit. So they thought, this guy is really skilled. Look at what he's able to do. And he said, "Well, hey, how about one of you coming with me? And we'll go across the Niagara Falls on the tightrope together." Well, believe it or not, nobody volunteered. They thought what he did was amazing, but nobody was going to volunteer. Until then, everyone had so much belief in his ability and was convinced that he would succeed, but now no one even dared to think about the risk involved. Suddenly, from nowhere, a little girl made her way out of the crowd and said, "I will come with you." The artist smiled, but there was a deathly silence and dagger looks in the eyes of the spectators. They said that the girl was insane and nothing less than crazy to go with this fellow and cross the falls. When they saw that neither relented, they cursed and abused the trapeze artist for his irresponsible behavior in risking the life of another human being. It was so ironic to witness the scene. It was the same crowd that a few moments before was praising the artist. The trapeze artist, along with the little girl, started the great crossing. And the crowd was too shocked and staggered even to voice its displeasure. They were absolutely sure of the ghastly outcome of this adventure. But to everyone's great relief, the trapeze artist, along with his little enthusiast, crossed over safely. The crowd, though relieved, again criticized the trapeze artist. Then the child looked at the artist and said, "Papa, let's go home." The entire crowd was stunned. The child said, "I have full trust in my father's ability, and I know that I am secure and safe in my father's arms." We're safe in our father's arms. We are and always will be, and this is the essence of trust. Mm-hmm.